Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSPMAG24.
Welcome to the ITSP Magazine Podcasts, a modern, innovative multimedia platform broadcasting ideas and connecting minds. You are about to listen to the On Cyber and AI podcast with Christina Stokes. Join Christina as she explores the crossroads of cybersecurity, AI, and the tech that's changing our world. Dive into conversations with industry leaders who are shaping the future, sharing insights on the impact and potential of these technologies. Ready to get a glimpse into tomorrow? You're in the right spot. Let's dive in.
Thank you for joining ITSP Magazine's On Cyber and AI podcast. I'm your host, Christina Stokes, and today's guest is Diana Kelly. I'd love for you to tell us about yourself, Diana.
Sure. I am. Well, first of all, thanks for having me here and congratulations on your new podcast.
Thank you.
And then I have been in IT for well over three decades, which is kind of like mind blowing when it's like, where did the years go? Somewhere. But I've seen a lot of different technology over the course of my career. And I, as many people did, started to get really interested in AI and how AI was going to change the landscape for us, starting back when I was at IBM. And we were training Watson for cybersecurity as part of what the team was doing to help others, you know, be able to take advantage of AI. And then when I was at Microsoft, I continued being really interested in this space and trying to understand the work, especially around ethics, which has brought me to where I am now, where I am the CISO. So I'm doing my security, but at a company called Protect AI, where we are focusing on creating tools to secure and creating a platform to secure the machine learning operations lifecycle.
What motivates you every day and why cybersecurity? Why have you stayed in this field?
What motivates me every day is just really, you know, making sure that kind of like not letting the bad guys win. If I had to like just distill it down to one thing, and it started because I got really fascinated in technology way back in the 1970s and what could be done with collaborative computing and connecting people and allowing us all to work together. So I was just so excited by what could be done. But by the time I was practicing professionally, networks had been joined together. Email was starting to become something that was, you know, commonplace in the workforce. So I know for a lot of people, you're like, there was a time before email. And it's like, yes, we would also ride our horses to work. But in any case, I had built and was very proud of a network for our startup that I was working for in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And this startup wanted to start distributing our patches using FTP, which was really kind of groundbreaking at the time. It was like, oh, instead of having to snail mail a patch on a disk, I know people are like, I swear there's a horse involved in here. So instead of snail mailing a patch on a disk, we could just allow our customers to come in and download it. So I was really proud that we had built that out, but someone attacked that server that we were using to do that and got onto my network. And it was at a very inopportune time. The first attack that we had was actually on a Christmas Eve.
They love weekends and holidays.
They do. They know that people are going home, and that was it. We had started to go home, and it was just me and a contractor, and we had to stay that night until we had figured out where it was, the attack was coming from, that we had not only eradicated it out of our systems, but we had made sure that we had prevented the problem so it couldn't be, they couldn't start the attack again. But I got kind of upset, not just because it was Christmas Eve, but what I really got upset about was that we had worked so hard to create this network and do good things with it for our company or for our customers. And then here were these attackers that were coming in and disabling us from taking, you know, the benefit of using our network. And I was like, never again. That's not okay. That is, you know, this isn't your network. It's ours. You shouldn't be trying to take and break it. So that really is what gets me up every day and keeps me motivated, is that I really do want to make sure that people can get all of the wonderful benefits of technology in as safe and reliable a way as possible. Obviously, there's no such thing as absolute security, and that is partly why we have to do our jobs every day, but to make sure that people have as low risk as possible as they're getting the benefits of technology.
Absolutely. Technology can be used as a tool or a weapon. So I love to hear that, you know, there are people working to keep it as a tool and prevent others from using it as a weapon. At Protect AI, you are the CISO. Is there anything you can share about what you're working on there?
Yeah, I mean, the company itself is we're building out a platform for building security into the machine learning and security operations lifecycle. And a lot of times people will say, but is machine learning AI? Mm-hmm. And a lot of generative AI is actually driven by machine learning. So as we secure the machine learning lifecycle, we create security within all of the different ways that those models are used, including generative AI. We also have tools that will help to protect interactions with generative AI once it's in production and in use, both from the person using it, making sure they're not asking or too much of that system or giving it sensitive data that they shouldn't, for example, and also making sure that they're not attacking the system by, you know, getting the system to do or say something that it shouldn't. So there's, you know, but this all begins at the beginning of the life cycle with our machine learning, with what models are we going to download? What data are we going to use to train those models? How do we train those models? Who trains those models? How do we label that training data if we are doing supervised machine learning? So all of those pieces, and then we create a platform that enables you from the beginning within the life cycle, you know, to create a machine learning bill of materials and do software composition analysis for your machine learning models all the way out to when you're in production and using generative AI.
What are one of the biggest misconceptions that you have seen or heard in regards to AI and what you're specifically working on in the space that you're in?
Well, the biggest misconception I hear is that machine learning or AI is so incredibly powerful and intelligent that it's going to be able to be powerful and intelligent in all different dimensions of knowledge. And that's not exactly the case. If we're talking about mathematics, mm-hmm. then computers are going to be able to do things that are better than people in a lot of cases. For example, if I gave you two 20-digit numbers right now to multiply, or gave me, right, both of us would take quite a while with pen and paper trying to do that manually. A calculator is going to be able to do that very, very quickly. And if it's been tested and deployed properly, it's going to be able to do it with a very high level of accuracy. Human beings aren't also that great sometimes with our math, right? Check the math. But there are other things that humans do that we don't necessarily count as part of intelligence, but actually do take quite a lot of intelligence to. So I use this example a lot, which is to pick up something and pick up a vessel and drink from it. This actually, to be able to pick this up, I mean, this could have been in a glass. I use glasses mm-hmm. a lot. Sometimes I pour this in. The amount of liquid that's in here, I actually can't see this right now. This could be full or it could be almost empty. If it was full, I need to create a different amount of grip strength. I need to put a different amount of force in my arm. There's a whole lot of math that goes on mm-hmm. with something very simple. But because human beings do this every day without thinking, we go, that's easy. Well, it's not necessarily easy. Now think about training an AI-driven robot to be able to pick up any kind of vessel and know the exact amount of strength to bring it up to, you know, to drink, right? So we don't necessarily get down to the levels of what intelligence is. And sometimes we overestimate how hard something is because it's hard for us, i.e. math. Mm-hmm. And we underestimate something that's actually pretty difficult because it's easy for us, like picking up a glass and being able to bring it to our mouths to be able to drink from it. So that misconception has led to I've heard things like, well, you know, the OpenAI, ChatGPT, you know, it passed the bar and it's going to be smarter than lawyers within 6 months. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily, because the kinds of intelligence that you need to have to be a lawyer isn't exactly the way that ChatGPT is working yet. One of the big problems with ChatGPT in the legal profession so far has been the quote hallucinations create statistically probable cases that could have, you know, been built a precedent. But it doesn't necessarily go and check to see if those cases are actual cases. Maybe it just invented some of those cases. So that misconception, the misconception that the AI is always smarter than us and that it's always going to be better than humans, I think that that's a big one that we just as all of us need to be thinking about where it's really smarter, what the best use cases are, and where we really need to have humans still involved with the thinking and the nuance. The other big misconception that is concerning and one that at Protect AI we're very much hoping to help with quite a bit, which is that some people kind of think that AI just got invented in November 2022 and that ChatGPT mm-hmm. was the first real deployment of AI. That's not the case. I had mentioned being at IBM when Watson for Cyber was being trained, and that was 8 years ago. Machine learning models have been in use in a number of different sectors and organizations, big pharma, for example, for, you know, trials and looking at data around new medications, for example, in financial services. Some of us may already be using ML within our financial services portfolio if anybody signed up for a quantitative or robo advisor, right? That's mm-hmm. machine learning driven. So the misconception that this just happened and now we have to think about how we secure it going forward. It's here. It's been in use in many, many organizations and sectors for a significant amount of time. And the most important thing is to understand that we need to build security into that life cycle the same way that we've built it into our other security life cycle. So if you're thinking about DevSecOps, build security into your development life cycle, MLSecOps, build security into your machine learning life cycle.
Great. I think that, you know, with the surprise everybody had with AI when it exploded last year, my thoughts did go to, well, we have had ML, and a lot of people don't realize just we have had ML and what that has been built into. And yeah. with AI, like, yes, it is smart, but it doesn't have the contextual knowledge that humans have from our own experiences. And that, I think, is an area that AI would need to train or learn in. And, yeah. you know, that's a very nuanced thing for it to be yeah. able to do as a machine. Yes. What have you learned, something new that you have learned in this field now that AI has been such a big piece of this now?
Well, I've certainly been on a journey of learning a lot more about how machine learning engineers and data scientists work, because I came to it from security. So I brought all my security knowledge in, but I wasn't a deep machine learning. I'm not an ML engineer myself. So it's really learning about data and how different data is in the machine learning and AI world, different it is thinking about data. You know, for example, if you're training a machine learning model, you may well want to train it on real live data. It mm-hmm. may be anonymized. You may give instructions to the model to not give out information about the training data, but you want to train it on live data very often, so that you know that it's been fit properly for its purpose. Whereas when you're thinking about software development, and you know I've been doing this for a long time with secure life cycles, with this development, like as you look at that, we were always about, don't let the real data out. Don't put production data into your training data, that you wanted to always have the separation of the data. And in machine learning, it's a very different world with the data.
Has there been any surprising lessons or key takeaways that you have gleaned over this process?
Yeah, I mean, I think as we're looking at all of the great research that's being done by the community, there have been a series of lessons. A big lesson was in the supply chain of machine learning itself, that we need to, of course, worry about the data and the models in the machine learning, but the machine learning is running on top of a platform very often, you know, or a management tool for workflow. So we have to also make sure that supply chain is secure. We can't just say, oh, machine learning's just in its own little bubble and it's separate. It's running in an environment. So we also have to make sure that we've secured that. So that's been a big sort of a big eye opener for me about mm-hmm. how we have to apply the security, not just to the machine learning operations lifecycle, but also to the environment that the machine learning, the models are going to be running in.
What are some of the challenges that you think we will see as we move forward and begin implementing AI into our different programs, and then especially for security programs from that perspective?
I think the first big challenge is just going to be able to weave security in to the entire life cycle, being able to get governance and be able to see, know, and manage what's happening in our machine learning life cycles, starting from where those models are coming from, as sort of a software composition analysis around the models and create a bill of materials. What models are we using? Who was training them? What data are we using? Where have those data sets been used within our environment? So I think that's a really big challenge, is to weave the security into the process.
Mm-hmm. What about wins? Has it helped in any way as far as security, implementing security programs?
I think that there's a lot of opportunity for big wins. We've already seen machine learning help us quite a bit in anomaly detection and in classification. Is this fish or is this not a fish? Is it perfect? But it already, most of us, if you're using an email from one of the big providers, or Microsoft or Google, machine learning is helping to make sure that the emails that get to you are legitimate emails. Again, not perfect, but certainly giving you a leg up and reducing the noise as much as possible. So that's been a nice win. Also looking at the anomalies and deviations from the norm, because that's where something machine learning is really good at: pattern matching and finding patterns in very, very vast amounts of data. So a human being seeing that something looks anomalous or off the baseline, you know, if you've got thousands or 100,000 users at your company, that could be really hard for a human to detect, but that's something where machine learning can be very, very good at showing you those little bits. Now, the anomalous flag or alert may not mean that something nefarious is happening in your organization, but it gives you a good view into where those analysts can look to see, is this something that we expected? Is this a human being a human, or is this a human being a malicious human?
Right. What are you most excited about at the intersection of AI and security?
I am very excited about the ability to look at the vast amounts of data and start to see perhaps patterns that we hadn't been able to see before about attacks, and also to help us understand, again, that deviation from the norm. I think that those are two really wonderful applications, and we're seeing, you know, some nice advances there. There's also potentially getting a little bit more agency and response on, you know, if something looks wrong, what action do we take in response? I think that might be, as we get better, we train, we go in observation mode, will we be able to get a little bit more proactive? That's fairly exciting. And then the other thing is around training, because some of these tools can really make it easier. They emulate what it is to be talking to a person. So give us some good opportunity for training and improving that training.
So you've been in cybersecurity for, as you said, across three decades. What has been one of the greatest pieces of advice that maybe a mentor has given you that has helped you throughout your career?
Believing that you can do it is actually one of my very first mentors. I was working in editorial, and my love of systems, I had started to do acquisitions of software for the textbooks that we were publishing. And the person that hired me into my first IT role, she saw me and that skill and thought I could do it. And I was like, I don't know. I think I have to have more tech or this. And she said, no, you've got it. You've already got that. And you know, I've heard that from other people in my career. There's a sense of that somehow you're going to get to a level suddenly and then you're that. But it's no, you go out and you do it and you build those skills, and nobody comes along and says, oh, now you're a threat hunter or now you're a SOC analyst. You might get that title, but it's the work that you've done to get into that role. So I think just really understanding and having faith in yourself, do the work, but then also give yourself credit that you have done the work, which, that's always been a little bit hard for me.
Yeah, I think that can be hard for a lot of people we hear about imposter syndrome and not feeling like, you know, we're supposed to be here, but we're here, we're doing the work. So
yeah.
What advice would you have to somebody who is looking at getting into either cybersecurity or specifically AI?
In both cases, what is it that you really love to do? Why do you want to do it? And I've talked to people going into security and now security of AI because it's the one that's getting a lot of attention right now. You know, and I've heard, well, because I don't want to be unemployed. I want to make a lot of money. You know, I want to get the bad guys. Okay, those are all good things. Think about why it is that you're going into this field. And then which part of the field that really interests you? There are highly technical roles in security and security for AI, and there are less technical roles. We need lawyers. We need graphic designers. We need sociologists to help us understand the psychology of the people that are responding to these systems. We need a whole lot of insight and intelligence around these problems of both cyber and AI. So what is it you love to do? Because if it's your passion and you love to do it, you're much more likely to succeed in it. Especially because you're not going to show up every day and I hate this. You're going to show up and just be like, I want to do this work. So that's really it. Understand what it is you want to do. Start to get a feel for which area is most interesting to you. And then once you've got that, you can get better advice and guidance on exactly what to do. If somebody says that they want a really technical path, they don't like people, they want to sit with their computer all the time, and they just want to look at code, okay, then they might be really good as a threat hunter. They might be good as a reverse malware engineer, or you know, be able to look for vulnerabilities in other systems, be a red teamer. There are a lot of things that might be better for that person. And then if that's where they wanted to go, I would say things like start going to the more technical conferences, go to CFPs and compete in CFPs, capture the, not CFPs, CFTs, CTF, sorry. capture the flag and participate in that. And then that's going to start building out a network and people are going to go, oh, this person has mad skills doing this kinds of work. Then that network could help you find a job. If you, as you're sitting and interrogating yourself, which part of this I like the most, if it's like, I really like the policy and I want to write the policy, but I want it to be the policy that gets adopted up in Washington, D.C. that becomes law. Okay, in that case, you're probably going to be veering more towards at least the government and potentially even legal so that you can go up on the hill and understand how to create laws and what those laws are like. And that would be a different path. So it's most important first to really understand which area of this practice you want to go into, and then you can start to tune your own path forward. However, there's one thing that in all of it, I think really does matter, which is networking, finding people. Even if you're I'm a huge introvert, even if you're a really big introvert, finding your people that you can talk to and finding the organizations and the groups that you feel comfortable with, they're going to A, help you really advance because they know things you don't know. So that's like, how do you learn? Sometimes it's by talking to other smart people. The other thing that will really help you advance is that a lot of times in these groups, they know someone who's hiring somewhere. And that can help you get that job or the next job, or at least understand what the skills you need to get that job that you want. So then you can create and craft your own plan for advancement.
I completely agree with that. Like that has been, you know, definitely helpful for me in my path. And then also just understanding what fulfillment means to you in selecting roles and different projects to work on. I think, you know, it helps because if you don't know what fulfills you, you don't know what your values are, you could get into a role and you can make tons of money, but it'll feel like a drag every single day. So, I mean, you gotta, you know, find it, what it is that you love and drives you. So, Diana, thank you for your time today. I just wanted to say I really appreciate your time and thank you for coming on as my first guest for the On Cyber AI podcast. We love you here at ITSP. So yes, thank you so much. And thank you to everybody tuning in.
Thanks.
Bye.
Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSPMAG24.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of On Cyber and AI podcast with Christina Stokes. If you liked this story, add this show to your favorite podcast player and share On Cyber and AI podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to connect your brand to this show and its audience, visit itspmagazine.com to learn how to sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey.